Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, spotlight on Edith Stein, the first Jewish-born saint. Taking a look at the Vatican-Wittenberg connection and joining our popular Latin lover as he speaks to us of the Bach brothers' love of Latin. Well, thanks so much for joining me. In a week's time, Pope Benedict will be on his first state visit to his homeland. A four-day visit which begins in Berlin on the 22nd of September and continues in Erfurt, winding up in Freiburg. So this time next week, he'll be precisely in Freiburg, a southern German city linked to the name of Edith Stein, the first Jewish-born saint who lived and studied in this university city and who was an outstanding philosopher. One of the people who knows her best, having supervised the German edition of her writings, is Carmelite Father Ulrich Dobben. I asked him a few questions. Let's listen. So, Father Ulrich, who was the Carmelite Saint Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, the first Jewish-born saint? What makes her so relevant to us in today's society?
Her personal history, her life, her personality.
What's so special about her personality?
Her personality as a very intelligent woman coming from a Jewish family. Outstanding philosopher in Germany. She was an assistant of Edmund Husserl for in these time. In these times, maybe he was the most famous philosopher in Germany. She got the doctorate with him, summa cum laude. And her conversion to Catholicism was not so normal because in this time many Jewish converted to Christianism, but to the Protestant confession. And she, led or convinced by Teresa of Avila,
who lived
in the 16th century in Spain, convinced by her, finally she decided to become a Catholic Christian in the Catholic Church.
The sequence of her conversion was strange. Jewish born, then she was atheist at one point.
She never uses the word atheist. She used the word unbeliever. And in the age of 14, it was in Hamburg, when she was in the house of her sister, she decided to give up all the prayers. It doesn't mean that she became an atheist, especially her niece living in California, the daughter of her youngest sister. She always insists, saying it is not a real atheism when a girl with 15 or 14 years old decides to give up the prayers. Another question is, in what an extent she had known the real Jewish religion? Because after, when she was a Catholic, she discovered the religious richness of Jewish religion. And I'm sure that after, as a Catholic, she was a better Jewish believer than before. The Catholic faith, the Christian faith, helped her to discover the richness of the Jewish religion.
She wasn't an atheist, as you said, but she was certainly a woman of doubt, a seeker.
Yes, no? Yes, a seeker. It's a very good word, a seeker.
Do you think that this doubt that she went through, this pain and this... When one doubts, so there's always a bit of pain, no?
Yes, sort of moral pain.
Confirmed her so much as a staunch believer.
She was always seeking, and she was always seeking because she didn't like to accept some things or some articles of faith when she hadn't studied them before as well as possible. It is interesting, before she converted to Catholic religion, she studied two very famous Catholic theologians, Johann Adam Möller and Matthias Scheben. In her times, these two professors were very famous with her dogmatic books. It means she wanted to understand the things well as possible with her intellect.
Now,
And this means that she was doubting and but also seeking always.
When she made her eternal profession on the 21st of April 1938, this erudite woman then, what you're saying, she was an erudite woman, she chose the words of another famous Carmelite, St. John of the Cross, to be printed on her devotional picture.
Yes.
But she wrote, "Henceforth my only vocation is love."
Yes.
So what is it? The intellect and love go together?
You must know that this text comes from the spiritual canticle of St. John of the Cross, the most outstanding poet in Spanish language. And she made a very good translation of this canticle later. I think that love and intellect are not in opposition, because a love without intellect is not good, and intellect without love is not even good.
So what you're saying, she's a very mature, complete person.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Two qualities complementing each other. One of the most important themes of John Paul II in his last encyclical, I think it was his last encyclical, when he spoke also about Edith Stein in this context. Fides
et
ratio, exactly.
Faith and reason, which is one of Pope Benedict XVI's great things.
He continues. Also, Deus Caritas est, you have the thing.
God is love. One can't speak of Edith Stein without speaking of Auschwitz. I think that she is well known for her experience
exactly.
at Auschwitz and her witness.
I think it is one of the other points why she is such an important person, such an outstanding person of the last century, because she finished in Auschwitz, and she had accepted this kind of death willingly, even if she tried to escape until the last moment. She was always hoping, but she was at the same time very resigned to accept it as God had decided for her. I think she testimonies that God was present in Auschwitz, giving her strength. But I think it is a very difficult question. We cannot speak so easily about God. But Edith Stein was convinced until the last moment that God is with her.
Pope Benedict, when he went to Auschwitz, he spoke of Edith Stein, and he said of her that he felt a deep urge to pause in a particular way before the inscription in German evoking her.
Ad Auschwitz-Birkenau, e qui sono morti,
and he said he greatly hailed her and the others as witnesses to the truth and goodness, which even among our people were not eclipsed. We are grateful.
Ringraziamo queste persone.
Because they did not submit to the power of evil.
Perché non si sono sottomesse al potere del male.
And now they stand before us like lights shining in a dark night.
Ci stanno davanti come luci in una notte buia.
The reading of Edith Stein, a light shining in a dark night?
I think so, especially when we take in consideration her end, because her writings giving really a testimony about faith, and especially her last writing, Signs of the Cross, about St. John of the Cross, is finishing with the light of the resurrection. Edith Stein in her writing, Signs of the Cross, is giving a comment about all the writings of St. John of the Cross, putting her own experience. It is a mixture between a comment and testimony of life. It finishes with the light of the resurrection. can suppose that in the last days before she was captured, she was writing this, because the writing is nearly finished, but it's only written by hand, it's only manuscript, it's a manuscript, and she was still working about it. And so we can suppose that in the last weeks before she was captured, she had developed these thoughts about the light of the resurrection following the prayer of the Angelus. The Angelus is the angel of the Lord, that we can come through his suffering and cross to the glory of resurrection.
Stein had to face the challenges of a radically changing century with its deep wounds and scars, a world of renunciation. No, she had to face that kind of world, whereas our Western world today is a world where everything is allowed. So what has she got to offer? What is the relevance of her witness to the new generations? There doesn't seem to be a lot in common.
I think that she was a person in search, a seeker. And I think under the relativism and under many other things we are living now, many persons are looking for values, are seeking for values, and so don't trust so easily the traditional values. But they are seeking. We should encourage the people to be seekers. Even if you are not always succeeding, maybe we are used to be succeeding, but faith is to be a seeker, in spite of all the insuccesses and all the problems you have, all the sins you are doing. It is important to remain in the way, to continue the way.
We mentioned two Carmelites earlier on in our talk, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, from whom she drew inspiration. Mm-hmm. Would you say that she has a particular Carmelite charism?
Yes, in a certain sense. She had entered very well in the traditional Carmelite charism, in the Theresian Carmelite charism.
Which, what is it? What is the Theresian?
The prayer, interior prayer. It's a typical Theresian charism when it was not so common in the order. And St. John of the Cross, yeah, she had understood him also, but maybe St. John of the Cross insists more in love. He doesn't never use the expression a science of cross, but a science of love. We know that the real love accepts also the cross, but Edith Stein insists more in the cross. There are many crosses in her life, many crosses, not only Auschwitz, not only Auschwitz.
St. Teresa, then, of the cross, where does the Benedicta come in, then?
Benedicta, blessed by the cross, yes. Her name became a reality in her life.
My thanks there go to Carmelite Father Ulrich Dobbin for sharing this information with us. And now moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to continue to focus on Germany in a way by bringing you an episode in our archive series, The Vatican Centuries. It's connected to the Reformation and Martin Luther. As we know, on Friday next week, the Pope will be in the land of Luther, in the city of Erfurt, where the father of the Reformation was ordained to the priesthood. Getting back to the episode, it begins as the long reign of the humanists was coming to an end and fascination with the classical past had waned. So when the joyous carnival in the capital of Christendom was cut short by the sack of Rome, an epoch of decadence set in.
The 16th century went into its third decade with Charles V as Holy Roman Emperor. And in June 1520, a treaty was signed between Henry VIII and Francis I at a spectacular meeting at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. This celebrated diplomatic event produced no results, and the following year war blazed between France and Spain.
In Rome, the construction of the new St. Peter's was making heavy demands, and in 1516, Pope Leo extended the Peter indulgence into Germany. Dominican friar Tetzel was appointed to preach.
It was a match to a bonfire. In 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg. The Reformation was alight.
The gay Leonine Carnival came to an abrupt end in 1521, when Pope Leo was struck down by pneumonia. His successor, Adrian VI, the last non-Italian pope until our own day, only reigned a year. He was followed by Clement VII.
There had been a lull in the building work on the new St. Peter's. Clement, like Adrian, tried to keep costs down, but was worried by alarmist echoes coming from Germany as a result of the application of a bull issued in 1510 by Julius II, conceding special favours, in special circumstances, to those who made offerings for the rebuilding of St. Peter's.
Clement's time was an unhappy one for Rome. Even the atmosphere was heavy. On the morning of May 6th, 1527, a thick fog followed the sunrise. Under cover of this, the imperial army of Charles V advanced to attack Rome. It was an army of desperate men, all unpaid mercenaries, thirsty for loot. As they stormed the Borgo, the Pope, dressed in full pontificals, was on his knees in St. Peter's, determined to meet the enemy with dignity.
But when the marauding armies swept through the frightened city, they met little resistance. They burst into the hospital of Santo Spirito and massacred the patients in their beds. The screams of the dying and the roar of the cannon could be heard on the steps of St. Peter's. The Pope was finally convinced to make his escape along the Passetto, the covered corridor leading to Castel Sant'Angelo. Had he stayed long enough to say three creeds, wrote an eyewitness, he would have been taken.
For 8 days, while the invading armies pillaged, burned, and slaughtered, the Pope was beleaguered in the castle, together with 13 cardinals and a group of 90 Swiss and 400 Italians. St. Peter's was overrun with the Bourbon army. They lounged on the altars, drank from precious chalices, stabled their horses in the sanctuary, and filled their litters with precious manuscripts. St. Peter's was desecrated. Shrines and tombs were rifled, and the veil of Veronica was dragged from tavern to tavern amid the ribald taunts of the soldiery. In the city, every kind of sacrilege and barbarity was perpetrated. The Saracens had been mild in comparison.
An enormous ransom was asked for the Pope. Benvenuto Cellini had sewn the jewels from the papal tiara into the Pope's robes, but these too had to go. Eventually, the Pope capitulated. A few months later, he left Rome disguised as a market gardener. Three years later, the unhappy pontiff was obliged to crown Charles V, the man who had humiliated him and left Rome in ruins, as Holy Roman Emperor. Clement died in 1534 and is buried in a magnificent porphyry urn taken from the Pantheon.
An eyewitness of the sack of Rome was the humanist Cardinal Sadoleto. In his sober comment on the event, he demonstrates the new spirit of reform in church and state.
If through our suffering a satisfaction is made to the wrath and justice of God, if these fearful punishments again open the way to better laws and morals, then is our misfortune perhaps not of the greatest. What belongs to God, he will take care of. Before us lies a life of reformation, which no violence can take from us. Let us so rule our deeds and thoughts as to seek in God only the true glory of the priesthood and our own true greatness and power.
The demand for reform was nothing new. The age was deeply religious, but no single man occupying the See of Peter at that time possessed the vision or the strength to reform the church from within.
When Martin Luther published his 95 Theses, he was nearing 34. He'd been an Augustinian friar for 12 years and had recently adopted a simplified theology based on his reading of St. Paul. It became known as justification by faith. For Luther, man depended on God's mercy and could not buy his way to heaven by giving alms or performing good works. The sale of indulgences enraged Luther, and he determined to expose the scandal, confident that the Pope would support him.
At first, Leo X paid little attention to the Wittenberg affair, believing it to be a monkish squabble, and merely told the head of the Austin friars to keep his men in order. But copies of Luther's theses had circulated rapidly, and popular support for him was growing. The Pope sent Cardinal Cajetan, general of the Dominican Order, to hear Luther. He ordered him to retract his theses. Luther refused. In a public confrontation with Dominican scholar John Eck, Luther denied papal supremacy.
There was now no turning back. Luther published pamphlet after pamphlet, moving further and further away from his original invitation to debate an abuse. In 1520, he published three manifestos, one of which attacked the sacramental system.
Rome could no longer ignore Martin Luther. On the 15th of June, 1520, the Pope issued a bull, Exsurge Domine, condemning 41 of Luther's propositions as heretical, ordering the faithful to burn his books and giving Luther 2 months to recant or be excommunicated. Luther responded by burning the bull in public.
Finally, in 1521, Luther was called before the Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms. Asked once more to revoke his writings, Luther refused. He was outlawed on the spot. Given a safe conduct, he lived for 10 months in disguise in the castle of Wartburg.
Luther's doctrine was formulated officially in 1530 in the Confession of Augsburg. He compiled a catechism, wrote hymns, and by 1534 had finished his translation of the Bible into German. By the time he died in 1546, the principles of the Reformation were widely established.
Finally, watch a change of pace and tone as I join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, as he chats to me of his favourite composers, who include the Bach brothers. Father, as we know, the official language of the Catholic Church is Latin, no? So the hymns we sing in church are all originally sung in Latin. For example, all the prayers like Pater Noster, the Magnificat, the Ave Maria, they've all been put to music. Have you got any favourite versions of these?
I was listening just this morning. An organ that with different variations of Schubert's Ave Maria, for heaven's sakes alive.
What are the words of the Ave Maria?
Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum. Benedicta tu in mulieribus et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Okay.
So people should know the words of that.
Well, yes.
Hail Mary, full of grace, etc.
They shouldn't know that much. Of course, nowadays, I don't know. But I was listening because I bought some organ music. The students gave me a gift of, and I bought all kinds of CDs with organ music. And there, of course, Schubert is there. And Gounod's Ave Maria. It's another one. It just make you cry. It's so beautiful.
The Gounod one?
Yeah.
Why does it make you cry?
I mean, the music is so beautiful, and the sentiments are so beautiful. You just don't know what to do.
How do you say that in
Latin? Nescis quid agas. You don't know what to do. Nescis quid agas.
Sentimental.
Well, yes, but I mean human.
Sentiments. Is that a Latin word?
Well, sentio sentire is to feel in Latin. So sensus are feelings, your senses, and sentimental are things that belong to your feelings. And that's what it's all about.
I know you're reading a book. It's a biography, is it, of Bach?
Yes, yes.
Is that right?
Christian Wolff's biography.
And you told me that he Latin.
It came up again today. He and his brothers, they all graduated from Lutheran Latin schools. They were all cultured and they were all educated in Lutheran Latin school. Yes. All of them. You know, about there are about 100 boxes, you know. But he and his brothers and so forth and so on, they all became organists and choir directors and composers and everything else. But they would always talk about their training in Latin school.
Getting back to the Catholic world.
That's good. Vatican Radio would be good too. Go on.
Getting back to the Catholic world. When I was a child, there were always sung masses on solemn occasions and Missa Cantata. What do you remember of Missa Cantata? Is that special?
Well, of course, in those days, every church had its own choir, and so the Missa Cantata was done by the choir. What Vatican II did, and I think very wisely, you know, was to get the people involved, you know, in singing. And so the fancy solemn masses sung by the choirs have kind of gone out. And now you have little booklets, and everyone in church is supposed to sing, which is a good idea. That's all right.
I just want to say this is a good idea in Latin.
Optimum Concilium.
So Vatican II, Concilium, Vaticanum.
Yeah, Concilium is and Concilium are two different words. A council and a council. Got it? You know?
So.
No, it was a good idea.
Vatican II was a good idea.
Oh, that was not why that
was. So how do you say that? Vatican II was a good
Optimum
idea.
Concilium fuit optimum concilium.
And can I add, by getting rid of Latin?
Well, Vatican didn't get rid of Latin in any way. The fact is, if you look at the document on the liturgy, you know, Sacrosanctum Concilium, they say the Latin language is the official liturgical language of the Roman Catholic Church. It's sitting there. What history did with Latin is another story. And even there, the training of the priests, you know, Optatam Totius, Optatam Totius, and so forth and so on, they say Latin is absolutely essential for the training of the priest. What happened historically, you know, is another story. So Latin was just thrown out historically, but not officially.
So you know. How do you say that in Latin? Latin was thrown out historically? I'm going to tease you here.
Historica rerum progressione eiectus est sermo Latinus. Okay, I can say that. Sed non auctoritate ecclesiae, not by the authority of the church. The church never did away with Latin. It just happened that way, got it? So you say no government ever came away and did away with horse and buggies, but just horse and buggies just kind of disappeared.
How do you say that in Latin? No government.
Nullum regium umquam prohibuit equos et caros. Said evanuerunt, but they just disappeared.
They vanished, evanuerunt.
Yeah, evanesco, certainly. This is all Latin. The whole thing's Latin, I'm telling you.
And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.